And then we definitely have that, right? N-I, N-J. Well, now there's, let's pull out a minus 1 to the S. So when S is 1, let's see, I can put the order here. I have delta IJ minus MI NJ. It actually squares to minus the projection operator. Right? This is minus some projection, where PIJ squared is P itself. So, let's see. Yeah, I want to pull out that sine because I want to turn this into a cosine. And then when, right, there's another case when S equals zero, I get just the identity. So there's one term here that's just the identity. And then
there's the cubic
term. Yeah, the odd one. So S equals zero to infinity, 1 over 2s plus 1 factorial. Okay, and we still get theta to the n here. So it will be theta to the 2s plus 1. And then, what we're going to get, what are the odd powers here? Do they all give
terms? With alternating signs, you come back to get them, and they're alternating signs, right?
Yeah. And then the d squared. But you notice that the number of d's on this side always matches the power. So you're always going to get, all right, so you have d dot j to the fifth. There's going to be a theta to the fifth.
Okay.
And then it'll be an n dot j there.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we have an n dot j, and is it alternating sign?
So
there'd be a minus 1 to the
end.
Yeah. And then, this isn't quite the cosine, because we need the s equals 0 term. Okay. So we add and subtract the s equals 0 term. I can write that as the identity matrix there.
Right.
But, so I need to subtract 1 minus ni nj, and then I add it back into this series as the zero f equals 0 term, so then I get the cosine theta times that operator.
Okay, I didn't know where I'm coming from.
So there's no extra theta.
Oh, I see.
And then a 1, and then this is a sine theta with an n dot j. Am I getting the right thing here?
That's right. Then your identities cancel and your n goes back to an ij.
Yeah, you could do it. You might do it this way. You might write, minus 1 minus cosine theta. I don't know which is, or should we cancel the identities? Either way. Cancel the identities, then we have an NINJ. Did we have that before? I don't remember that.
Yes, we did. By last year.
Okay.
So identities.
But, so what did we do with that term?
What did we get?
NINJ.
Did we do this one?
That zero term. You just threw that cosine theta into the parentheses there. Oh, you're also
there.
Yeah,
I think we may have goofed. Let me do this again.
I don't think you have to.
All right, this is okay, I've got a 1 here. So it seems to me I need to add NINJ and then subtract it. So I've got 1 minus NINJ. these two together are that. But then we also have that factor here, so this is on the sum s equals 0 to infinity.
Oh, there you go.
Minus 1 to the s. Theta is 2s over 2s factorial. And then n hat dot j sine theta.
That's equivalent to what you read.
And then that's cosine. So we've got this operator, 1 minus nij. Times cos theta. Plus ni and j plus n dot j sine theta.
That is equivalent to what you had in the first place anyway. You canceled the ones and then distributed your cosine, you'd have exactly the same thing.
1 cos theta,
It's not the same as this.
No, because it has an extra term.
It's the same extra term. You didn't change anything algebraically.
Yeah, this is missing that middle term.
Yeah. So which one's right? So
I think this one's right. I think this is right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So check your notes, guys. I may have lost the term here. I think when you do SU2, you don't have to add that zero term back in. It works out right. But when you're doing SO3, I think you have to add and subtract that to get the cosine. I think this is right. But let's check it geometrically. Let's look at what this does acting on some x, to rotate it, right? So we let this act on, this is a matrix, ij. I let it act on some xj, and I get some new x. Right, so my x tilde I is just x dotted into all this stuff. This term is going to be that n times n dot x. We want that term because that says that the part along the axis doesn't change. Then we have a part. This is a projection perpendicular to the axis. We did this geometry, and this works right. How'd that happen? So here we have x minus n hat dot x. When this x is contracted on that thing, that's times cosine theta. And then we have n dot j acting on x, n dot j ij xj sine theta. And we need to figure out what that is. Well, that turned out to be a cross product. Because jij, let me write it this way. This is nk jk. Where JK is a matrix like this, but that matrix is epsilon IKJ, I think. So for K equals 1, then that's 2, 3, so row 3, column 2 would be 1 minus 1. Is that what we had? I forget which way we defined them. We might have defined them with the opposite sign. It's just a matter of the direction of rotation, actually, which way you define those. Minus sign on theta.
I think they're
going
to go into
minus.
We've gone back and forth.
We made it so that's why IJK is just a JI matrix with JK elements.
So is this J1?
Yeah, that's J1, yes.
That one.
Or with opposite sign.
Opposite sign. Okay, so this is minus J1. Okay. So then, JK. So it's plus minus 1. There we go. All right, so that tells us how to write this thing. This thing is then n sub k, And JKIJ is epsilon IJK. And then we have XJ. And this is Cartesian. I think, let me write that as epsilon. No, I, J, K. That one of the K's should be up here. There we go. X, J, and K. That's the I component of X cross N. Okay, where I think we've got our signs consistent with our conventions here. So we take the component of X in the N direction, and we keep it unchanged. Just put it back. Then we take the part of X in the XN plane, we subtract the part of X lying along the axis, and that's taken times cos theta, and then we take the part of X that is orthogonal to N, and orthogonal to X, and to make that sine theta, and that is certainly correct. Up to the sine of the direction of the rotation, that's exactly how I would expect to get a rotation. Okay, so here's the deal. We've got some unit vector N. We want to rotate around that direction. Okay, we've got some general vector X. We take the part of X that is parallel to N. So think of X as built up out of two pieces. The piece along N is, take N dot X, that's X cosine theta, and then multiply that by N, and that becomes this vector. So this vector is that. Draw a picture here. Okay. Then this vector there is the part of X, or it lies in the XN plane, but it's the part perpendicular to N. That's exactly what this is. This is the difference between X and that piece. So if I take X and subtract that vector, what I'm left with is that vector. So it's precisely that is X minus its projection in the N direction. Okay, now X cross N is into the board. So that's the tail of a vector. X cross N is in. So now look in the plane of these two vectors, of X cross N and this one, X minus N hat dot X. Okay, so I'm looking in this plane perpendicular to N. And I want to see what the rotation looks like. The rotation takes place in that plane. So, there we go. So, this dot is going to be, let's see, which way am I looking? Let's draw. This vector is X minus and hat dot X. Perpendicular to it, we have a vector. Now, what's the length? What's the length of that vector? This is X cross N. So this is the magnitude of X cross N, all right, is equal to the magnitude of X times the sine of theta. Right? That's exactly equal to the magnitude of this thing. That's the length of that, right? That's the magnitude of, right, this is x, times sine theta gives that side of the triangle. So, this is the same as the magnitude of that other vector, x minus n hat n dot x. So, these two have equal magnitudes. And the magnitude is equal to the magnitude of x that's perpendicular to the axis of rotation. Question? Now, what we're doing is then we're taking this thing times cos theta and that thing times sine theta. That gives us a vector that is of the same length but rotated by an angle theta. Right? So what I claim is that this vector has a component along that direction that is that vector times cos theta, and a projection along this direction that is that vector times sine theta. And that's, you know, your basic trig, just the projection. So what we're getting is right, that's the net effect of where'd it go? These two terms. Right? These two terms become that rotated vector. Then the part of x along n is unchanged. That just comes along. So the final vector is this one, that projection there, together with this one that's rotated in this plane. So we rotate in this plane, and the final vector is up here, and it's just been rotated around n. It's exactly the right thing.
This is correct.
Yeah, if that doesn't say this, it's wrong. I do remember having to add and subtract that term in this. I didn't know what happened that day. So, anybody have any questions on that? It's a nice geometry, you know. It's nice to see how you can, you know, break down or, you know, a rotation of a vector and, you know, use not products to express it. And it's very nice that the way to write that just comes out of group theory. So, okay, good question. Nicely cleared up a mistake. And let's see, are there any other questions?
I have a question on gauging. Okay. So when we gauge one group by a certain subgroup,
yep.
then we're forming a set for every element in that subgroup, is that correct?
Forming a set. No, each coset looks like the subgroup. Alright, so we're
putting that subgroup at each point that's not that are the same gauge.
Yeah, do an example of a quotient. Let's do an example of a quotient.
Okay.
I was thinking about this. I was reading online, and there's a simple theorem you can prove that says that when you take a quotient by a compact group, by a compact subgroup, the resulting manifold is Hausdorff. Well, whether a manifold is Hausdorff depends on what topology you define on the manifold. And in fact, you know, you can probably make any group quotient into a Hausdorff manifold. But I was doing some simple examples just to see if I could, you know, demonstrate that to myself. So let's do a let's take a quotient of the plane by a dilatation, like a two-dimensional by conformal space. And we'll see what happens. So, take the xy plane. It's actually you can think of this as a one-dimensional phase space. Let's actually do that, x and p. Because in fundamental units, x has units of length. But momentum, it's got units of kilogram meters per second, but those aren't very fundamental. So let's divide by Planck's constant. So then we're dividing by kilogram meters per second, that's meters. So what we get is 1 over meters as the unit, 1 over length. So we'll do momentum in units of Planck's constant, and then this has units of 1 over length, this has units of length. So if I change the scale, if I change my units from meters to centimeters, x is going to go to some positive factor times x. Now let me make sure the factor is positive by just writing the exponential of the factor, but it's just a trick to keep it positive. But the momentum is going to go to 1 over that, which I can write as either minus lambda times p. So they scale that way. All right, now there's only one transformation here. It forms the Lie group. So this group transformation, this is a Lie group transformation of the plane. Now, I can think of the plane as a group that has two translation generators. So, we can think of the plane as, what should we call it? Let's think of a two-dimensional translation group. So, in the plane, it'll be abelian, right? The generators, a translation in the x direction commutes to the translation in the p direction. I can go up and over, or over and up. That's what makes Euclidean planes Euclidean. So, okay, that's a group. This is a subgroup of that. It's a combination of things, though, because note what happens here is that x times p over h bar is going to go to e to the lambda x, e to the minus lambda p over h bar, those factors cancel, and it's unchanged. So, this transformation leaves xp over h bar equals constant unchanged. So it maps that curve into itself. X and p change separately, but that curve doesn't. So that's just a set of hyperboles like this. So this is xp over h bar equals constant for different values of the constant. And, you know, there would be similar things in the other quadrant. So what the transformation does is move you along these curves somehow. So we could call this, what it's called is a dilatation. And what a dilatation does is move you along some hyperbole. So that's a subgroup. it's some messy combination of these, but we can take the quotient and let's see. So what is this cosine? If we take the quotient over, let's just call this
deeper
dilatation. Yeah. What are the cosines? Well, so let's pick a G. So then we have D sub G is the set of all G equals X, Y. They're just points, right? Translate by X and then you translate by Y. Such that G prime is equal to the action of D, D on G, but that means that X prime Y prime is equal to some e to the lambda, e to the lambda x, e to the minus lambda t, and we just figured that that's some other point on that hyperbola line. So if we start with a point here, x, y, the coset is exactly that first one. And points on that hyperbola are in one-to-one correspondence with the dilatation. There's one point on that line for each value of lambda. Right? So the subgroup D is just the set of all e to the lambda, where lambda is a real number. And clearly, there's a one-to-one map between some hyperbola like that and the real. So each of these hyperbolas is a coset. So,
because they're fibers in the bundle, right?
D1, D, this is G2D, and so on. Those are the fibers. Those are the fibers. And what we're going to claim is that if we take one point off each fiber in a smooth way, what we get is a manifold. So, let's restrict this to the, upper plane. Let's not worry about the signs here. Then things behave themselves. We can choose. Yeah, we would have to worry about some things. Then we have a probably not simply connected group. if I choose one point off each of these in a simple way, what I get is something that's isomorphic to the real line. I get essentially a real line. Well, it does not include the point at zero unless I, add in some. If I allow lambda to go to infinity, compactify the group system, but never mind. But okay, so lambda is not infinite, not negative infinite. So it comes up just to zero, but not including zero, and it goes off exactly as far as we like. And we could certainly find some way to map that open-ended line into the real. So the manifold, we haven't proved our theorem for this yet, is just R1. So the group sweeps out the coset. Each coset looks like the group. Now, if we look at let's take the point 1, 1. Let's see, is that what's the identity here? Oh, I guess the identity is 0. Yeah. There are things I should sort out about this example. we probably want 0 to make the plane a group.
Zero,
but yeah, you see what's happening.
Lambda equals 0 is x and t equals t.
Yeah, you know, it's basically an additive group, so we want the 0. We want 0, the origin, to be the identity of t2, which works fine for t2, but then covering this with hyperbola starts to get messy because you've got this funny singular point there. This is actually, let's see, what is that? That's a different orbit. These sets are sometimes called orbits of the group. So, you know, that's an orbit of the dilatation group. Let's not waste time on ironing out the origin here. Let's pick a different example, and you know, we can work out the groups there. work out the cosets there.
Without actually working it out, how would you deal with the origin?
Well, let's see. I suspect that the problem here is that the what is the problem? Yeah, if I knew I'd just
are you going to make a domain restriction? Or are you going to
match
the whole thing, or what?
The thing is, I came up with this T2 rather quickly. Making it a group, it's not a very interesting group, and I'm wondering if there's something about that's the problem. Or it may be there may be some topological obstruction to the dilatations actually being a subgroup of T2. I may not have set this up quite right. I mean, it's an easy way to show what an orbit looks like, what a coset looks like. But let's see, is this. You know, I think that's probably the difficulty, is that the dilatation group is the group that acts on the plane, but I don't see offhand why it should be thought of as a subgroup of the translation group. Right? I don't think it's a subgroup of this group. You know, there might be some sense in which we could make that the case, but that's why we're running into problems with this not working.
Careful enough in our original definitions.
Well, okay, the theorem that I was getting to here is that if we take the quotient of a Lie group by a Lie subgroup, the results are manifolds. All right. Now here, the result is actually an orbifold. We've got a singular point.
Yeah.
Right. We get four copies of the reals and then some funny point. So we're not really getting a manifold, and the problem is that D is not a subset of T, a subgroup of T2. Right.
That makes sense that it wouldn't be
T2. Yeah, translations aren't going to move you along like that.
Right.
Let's think of an example where we really have a subgroup. We looked in real detail. Oh, we got a better picture. I wish you could have gotten a photo of it. Hey, maybe I can draw it again. Can we remember what it was? All right, we were looking at the cosets of of what was it? SO2 in SO3.
Right.
And what we had looked at was we were looking at phi naught JZ, the set of all this times e to the theta, or was it the other way? Which was B and which was B?
Oh, this one that had the curvy sides that don't connect.
Yeah.
Across the
thing. Yeah, so we took an element here and we were going to rotate. So let's see, one of these rotates.
With this one here.
The other way?
Yeah, back.
Yeah. And that's B. So, okay, so our subgroup is SO2, and our full group, so our fixed element is some element of SO3. So we take an element of SO3, we multiply it by every element of the subgroup, that gives us our coset. And what we found was that we had a, well, it started for some reason around the back. And that was the axis, and we go to an XYZ here. What happened was it lies in a plane, and went along a curve. Let's see, was it the So these opposite points on the surface were on the curve, and then there was a curve around the back on which m hat at theta lies. So the angle for, you know, here's m hat at theta, unit vector that sweeps around in that half plane on the back of the sphere. But what we found is that the closest approach, we hadn't quite done this, and you had to go one, but the point of closest approach actually is the midpoint. So the shortest, the smallest angle of rotation is the half wedge point. These two points rotate the full direction, so the actual set of rotations comprising the coset looks like this. So that is the coset pH. I don't know. Is that picture any better than we had a nice careful picture of it?
There are curves that go all the way up to the back.
Yeah, so in the plane of the coset, it looks like this. all right, the plane of the crook, the plane of the coset intersects the center of the sphere. And we've got a bisector here, so m hat at pi was one end, m hat at minus pi was another, and m hat at zero was halfway around. So m hat sweeps along this way. M hat is a general theta, is something like that. But then alpha changes with theta as well. It turns out that alpha is maximum at the end and minimum at zero. You can get that just by differentiating the expression for alpha. But what was our expression for alpha? Did we have it?
It's got an expression cosine.
Yeah, cos alpha was what?
A naught squared cos theta minus 1 over a naught squared plus 1.
And if you take...
So wait, it was through... It lied along a plane that was through the 2 points and the center of the sphere? Is that what we decided? I was trying to think through that, and that doesn't work geometrically.
Wait, ask it again? What?
You said it was on a plane that intersected the center of the sphere, right?
Yeah, the plane of that curve goes through the center of the sphere, of the ball.
It goes through the 2 points. So if you were to make it so that that plane also included the central line and go across, that doesn't work because you'd have to cross fibers to get across the center.
Well, the plane is not the coset. That line is the coset.
Right. But say you went off center.
Yeah.
Off center this direction, say, and then directly across so that this line lied on your plane. You couldn't get from this point to this point on the plane without crossing that line. Does that make sense?
No. No. This is a coset here.
Right.
Right down through the middle. And the only place that that line intersects the plane of that coset is the origin.
I'm thinking.
It's going right through this way somehow.
Okay.
How did we do? We differentiated this.
Okay, I'm seeing why I'm wrong. Okay. I've got 2 points that I'm thinking are distinguishing a different line. Yeah. It's not a fully determined plane, so you can rotate that plane to... That just tells you an axis of the plane, so you can actually rotate it.
Yeah. Okay.
That makes sense. Okay, sorry. I was a little confused.
No, that's okay. So we differentiated this expression. What did we do?
We approximated that cos alpha was approximately cosine theta.
Alright, if A0 is... it's large. If phi naught, I remember that. Right at the end, we were talking about this. Okay, if I differentiate, let's take the differential of this. D of cos alpha is minus sine alpha d alpha. And on the other side, we get, a naught squared and minus sine theta d theta over a naught squared plus 1. So, let's see, sine alpha is nasty. It's the square root of 1 minus this squared. So, I'm not sure this is going to help much, but... all right, what I want to find is d alpha d theta, and that's going to be some constant a naught squared over a naught squared plus 1 times sine theta over sine alpha. Where sine alpha is all that junk. And let's see, we want to find the extrema of that, so we're going to set it to 0. Oh, that helps. So the extrema occur, just multiply by sine alpha. I mean, there are cases to check there, but certainly we get extrema when theta is 0 or plus or minus pi. Well, plus or minus pi correspond to the endpoints here. And those are maxima, theta equals 0 corresponds to the middle. And that's what showed us that we had a minimum at theta equals 0.
Are those the only critical points?
Well, you have to worry about this factor in the denominator. If this goes infinite anywhere, well, I don't see how it could. It could go to 0, but that's not going to make it 0. So I think those are all the critical points. Exercise. Check. right? You're taking note of all these exercises, right? Okay, so there we go. Cook said, you know, these things are going to wrap around different ways. We found that the plane of M, formed by all the M hat, was perpendicular to a vector L hat, and L hat only depended on theta naught, on phi naught. You guys remember this? L hat was something like zero, and then we had some function of phi naught and one. Right. So the direction this plane lies. Okay, L is the normal to this plane. All right, point sort of back that way here. Well, as we vary phi naught, you know, that's going to probably sweep around. So we're going to get this shape like that. And then if we choose, you know, J Y or J Z here, we're probably going to fill out the sphere in some more complete way.
There's one point that might be tough to fill out. I don't know. When the plane includes that line, it's going to be tough to fill out.
When the plane includes...
as you rotate that plane out, at one point, it's going to include that center line and then up to the bottom.
Yeah, except the only plane that does is one that goes to the endpoints, and that's the identity here. We've checked that one. That'll probably be the only plane that does.
Okay.
All right. The group element you start with is either the identity or some rotation. So you're going to rotate off that axis. You know, regardless of what group element you choose here, you're always rotating somewhere off the axis.
Right. But it restricts anything off axis from having that plane. That was what was hanging me up. I was thinking one plane.
Well, you know, this is probably not the way to do it. You know, what you want to do is prove a theorem, right? You want to prove that no two cosets ever intersect, and we can do that in general. So that's what we want to do, because this gets very, very hard to visualize. And, you know, I mean, let me tell you what happens here. I mean, this ball is filled with cosets. There is exactly one coset through every point of this ball. We'll prove that next. And if you look at the set of cosets, it's the two-sphere. It's a two-dimensional surface of the sphere. That's two. You'll never see that from this picture. I don't see it. If you see it, great, but I don't see how you're by taking, you know, calling each of these cosets one point, you can show that the result has the topology of the two sphere. But it does, and you know you can prove this. You can prove that the quotient group of S O N by S O N minus one is the N minus one sphere. Yeah.
We get like a solid circle. Is that correct?
Just the surface of a ball.
Okay.
Right. So that's the two sphere. F2 is S1 is the circle. F2 is the surface of the sphere.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry.
And then the ball. S3 is the whole ball. The solid
ball. Right. So it goes from the entire solid ball to just the surface.
Yeah, but not necessarily that surface.
Right.
Although that might be since maybe that's the way to see it. If you pick one representative from each coset, pick the one at the surface, and then you know it's clear that you're going to be covering at least part of it. Points are identified, so you may not get.
I'd say cut the thing in half.
You could get the whole thing. So
cut the thing in half, and the way it seems to be expressed. Once you got that half, you got the circle, but it's also got, as long as identified points can, I can see how you could make a sphere out of it. I don't know. It's not obvious that it is, but you could make a sphere.
That's density by choosing, you know, the points on the surface. The problem is that you're really getting 2 points on the surface for every one coset.
Right.
So that's not going
to
be
an
answer.
Any sphere would have to be re-identified to expand it to be a full sphere from a half sphere.
Nonetheless, the quotient is the whole two-sphere. And, you know, proving that is, you know, that's something you want to use different techniques to do. You never know. You might get it by drawing pictures, but I suspect not. Let's prove the theorem. let's prove the theorem that the coset, that there's exactly one coset through every point, that every coset is, no two cosets intersect, right? So they form a disjoint cover of the entire original group. It's a foliation, right? We're running a bunch of threads through this thing, and there's one thread for each point. So let's see what it takes to get that. It's not too hard a theorem. Did you try it?
No.
Nathan, did you give it a go? I'm not sure we had quite enough definition to really let you go off and do it on your own. It's a proof of the kind that you find all the time in topology, and I don't know, have any of you had topology courses? No. Okay. it's a checking element of sets. It's not a difficult thing. So let's see. What is our claim? If two cosets intersect, then they coincide. Another way to say it, either. Let me introduce the notation here. Let G1H, G2H be two cosets of H in G. Then either G1H intersection G2H is the empty set. Are you familiar with this notation? This is the set with no elements in it. Intersection means all the points that lie in both of these. Or
do we have to be careful about the set that includes the null set, or do we care?
Well, let's be careful, but I don't think it'll come up.
That's what I was asking. Do we care?
The set that contains the null set
is not a null set, actually. It contains the null set there.
Right. It's a different set.
The
set containing the null set, actually, this is a construction you can do. You can construct the integers this way by taking set containing the null set and containing the set containing the null set, etc.
First assignment I turned in an analysis before I even knew the whole deal. I was annoyed.
So either they have no elements in common or they have all elements in common. Okay, so we need a proof. G be an element of one of the cosets, G1H. Then there exists H in H such that G is equal to G1H.
If these are left coset.
No.
We haven't left or right coset yet. We've just done left.
Yeah, sorry, let's just stick with that. You know, take one, stick with it. You can do the whole thing the other way, but it's just a way to be specific.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't understand that distinction. Left versus right.
Oh, it's just whether we're multiplying this G on the left of H or on the right of H. We could construct a set of cosets by multiplying H on the right by G1, and we'd end up doing everything the same. It's just, we need to take one and then go with it.
Okay.
Suppose the intersection is not empty. Then there exists let's call it G0 in G1 that's also in G2H. Alright, so if the intersection is not empty, it contains a point. At least one point, pick one and call it G0.
G0 is not necessarily the same for G1 and G2.
G0 is necessarily the same point here and here.
Right.
I mean, that's the intersection.
Well, yeah, but G0-1... Okay, yeah.
G1 and G2 are clearly G1 and G2.
All the G's, all the G's are some points in curly G.
Okay.
Yeah, so should I say that somewhere? G1, G2 elements of G. The cosets are subsets of curly G, so any points we're talking about are points in curly G. Okay, everybody with me? Any questions so far? But then there exists H1 such that G0 equals G1 H1. There exists H2 such that G0 equals G2 H2. That's what it means for G0 to lie in each of those cosets. Okay, so...
Guess what I was asking is G1 and G2 are not necessarily the same. If G1 times it,
G1 and G2 are... for us to even contemplate these as distinct cosets, they are necessarily different.
Okay.
Yeah. If they're the same... The theorem's done because we're here. Okay. You want to be clear about this sort of thing.
I was going to say.
So, G1 H1 equals G2 H2. This is for some particular H1, H2. And those. We already have G equals G1, H. But this relationship implies that I can write G1 as G2H2H1 inverse. Right? Remember, H is it's a least subgroup, so it is in fact a group. So the inverse has to be in H. The inverse of any element in H has to be in H. So that's some element of H. So this becomes G2H2H1 inverse. But by closure,
H2H1 inverse has to be another H.
Exactly. Is an element of H. So G is an element of G2H. Okay. Remember the assumption we started with was that G was in the first coset. And what we've proved is that if the cosets intersect, then G is also in the second coset. So, so here's the conclusion, if of this part. If G1H intersection G2H is not empty, then so our conclusion so far, G1H is a subset of G2H. That's what we've proved. Does everybody see that we've proved that? We picked an arbitrary element of the first set and showed that under that condition it has to be in the second set.
Okay.
So now we do the same thing in the opposite
direction.
You see, starting with G in G2H, and we see that G2H is a subset of G1H. Therefore, G2H equals G1H. The two cosets are equal. So, if they intersect at all, they're equal. Topology is like. You spend a lot of time showing that elements of this set are or are not in that set. This is the kind of thing you do all the time. It's fun. It's fun stuff. Tricky. It's a little different than like algebra.
You do a little bit of analysis.
Yeah. It underlies analysis. Okay, let's do another claim. The proof's immediate, so I'll let you do it. You're getting exactly one, and I think this does it here already. Yeah, I mean what you're saying is right, that you know if we have some element G at some coset, G is either in that coset or not.
Right.
Let's prove.
Oh, wait, no.
You know, let's get this step first. Can you prove that G is in at least one coset? What's that?
The element of Curly D. Well, so.
Yeah. So.
Exactly. So, by definition.
What? Definition of what? If the element of Curly G, we're proving that every element of Curly G lies in some coset. So, what's the proof?
Well, it'd be a contradiction, assuming it does not.
We're taking every G multiplying by the entire set H, you know.
Yeah. So. So what do I write?
I don't know, a good contradiction.
No. G lies in GH. From the coset of G. Gosh, that was easy. So, just take G as your base group element to form a coset. So, clearly it lies in that. But we've just proved it can't lie in any other coset. So, we're done.
It cannot
lie in any distinct coset. Any other coset it lies in is identical with this one. So, that's the one it lies in.
I think I was saying the exact same thing, slightly different, and it was off.
And proof by contradiction?
Well, I would use contradiction to say it lies in one coset, and say if it lies in more than one coset, then that coset is identically the original coset, therefore it's contradiction.
Yeah, you were going confusing.
Yeah.
Good.
So, that's what I was thinking.
Okay. So, let's see. So, think back to that sphere. So, somehow, all those threads that run through that sphere manage to not intersect, and they fill the sphere. So, we've just proved that. Although, it's extremely hard to see. How all those threads are going to dodge one another.
Especially if they all land planes, that means they can't all, no two threads in the same plane.
No, I mean, many have to lie in the same plane, because you have to fill every point in that plane has to be in one coset. Right, so if this is the plane, and we've got one coset that does that, we have other cosets that are filling out that plane somehow. That plane is totally threaded.
Are you working that plane that we're doing? Is there an end to it?
Well, not a very pretty picture.
I don't know if you can see the rotation plane because it's
four. Yeah, so as we change phi naught, as we change the group element, we know that front plane rotates.
Right.
Each of those planes, has to be totally threaded. Every point in each of those planes is in some coset. Let's see. Yeah, it depends on. Yeah, that depends on phi naught too, right? Because as we vary theta, we get one. But now we have to vary group elements over all of SO3,
right?
And find the cosets of those. Well, a one parameter family of those lies on any one coset, so we're going to have two dimensions worth of cosets. Right, we have a three-dimensional group, we're dividing it into little one-dimensional pieces, so the number of pieces have to be two-dimensional. So S2 is the right number of points of cosets.
I think I just saw how you could prove it with the picture. If you cut it in half, you have an extrema that's the minimum of the center. That means that you're going to have an extrema that's here and here, so you're going to have two extremes, and then the minimum in the center, so you're going to have something that's got a minimum here.
Yeah, I can see it. Okay.
Never mind. It works in my head, don't worry.
Okay. Write a proof.
I'll work on it. Write a proof.
Okay, so now let me think where we want to go from here. Let's see. We've got... We'd like to show that they form a manifold.
Right. This is
possibly the next important result. It gives us our arena for gauge theory to show that taking the quotient of a Lie group by a Lie subgroup gives a manifold. So let's see if we can prove that.
Seems almost like it's the last big mathematics thing we have to really prove before we get our teeth in.
We want the Maurer-Cartan equation. We'll keep doing some math. This is probably the most formal thing we'll do. The rest is showing that we can write some things in some different ways that are useful. This is probably the most formal proof. This and the next one. So let's try the next one. Jason? You guys got time for another? Should we try and do it? How you doing?
Well, I'm going to have to leave in, 35 minutes.
Okay. Well, let's see how far we can get in 35 minutes.
Is that long?
What's that?
Is that long?
I don't know. Let's see. We may get through sooner. Let's see. So here's the next claim.
We're done on your own.
There was something I wanted to talk about before this. Okay, we've talked about quotient groups now. We've proved stuff about cosets. But before I prove this, we may want to talk about two simpler quotients. Okay, the quotient of a Lie group by a discrete subgroup. There's another Lie group.
You're also going to talk about normal subgroups.
And that's the second thing. Thank you. The quotient of a Lie group by a normal subgroup is another group. In general, the quotient of a group by a normal subgroup is a group. Doesn't matter whether it's a Lie group or not. And then finally, the quotient of a Lie group by a Lie subgroup is a manifold. So we're getting more general here. But there's an important point about the discrete subgroups. So let's look at that. The quotient of a Lie group given group, it has a unique Lie algebra.
Oh.
So this addresses the question of whether you can go back. What we've shown is that, I'm not sure I did this in general yet, but I think it's pretty clear from the examples we've done that by exponentiating the Lie algebra, you get a Lie group. And we might want to do that.
We've done that, actually.
Well, we didn't. We've done examples.
Yeah.
We've done examples. it's the converse of the thing we showed the other day where we were writing out all these nasty infinitesimal group elements and multiplying them out. Let's see. What we want to show is that. Let's list some claims and see what order we want to put it in.
Exponentiate the group to get the algebra.
No, exponentiate the
algebra
to get the group.
Okay.
Yeah. So the algebra is this vector space. Things that are linear combinations of generators. And we saw that exponentiating linear combinations of generators gives the group back. In the cases we've done. In general, you find that there can be two different groups that have the same Lie algebra, and those are generally called, those will be homomorphic. Homomorphic groups, let me just give you the definition. A group homomorphism. Call it phi, is a map taking one group to another group such that which preserves the multiplication. And by preserving group multiplication, suppose G1 is, it's some set and some operation times, let's call it. Let's let G2 be some other set and some other operation. Certain dot space. Then what we require is that for all G1 and I call this G and H. Do you mind? Sorry. I just need some notational flexibility here. So let elements of G be G's, and then phi of any G is an element of H. So we require that phi of G1, and then we use the product in H, so multiply by phi of G2. What you get has to be phi of the product back in G. So if G1 and G2 multiply to give that element, then phi of G1 times phi of G2 has to give phi of that same element, that G3. Okay, that's what I mean by preserving group multiplication. Well, it's possible to do this in a fairly trivial way. So I could have let me think about this now. Here's an example that shows you a discrete case. Let G be an element of O3. Remember, O3, the determinant of an O3 transformation has to be plus or minus 1. It has to square 1. Let phi of G, equal that G. So, that's an element of the set 0, 1, and that's our H. Excuse me. This is sending a whole lot of elements to one element at H. Nonetheless, it's a homomorphism. Homomorphisms can be many to one. The idea of an isomorphism is a one-to-one onto map that does the same thing. So if we have a if we have a homomorphism that is bijective, then these two are the same group. They're different names. You know, we're calling the elements different things, but in morally, they're the same group. Right? They're
different names for the same thing.
Different names for the same thing. Yeah. We try a lot of different names for the Boolean group, you know. Just addition mod 2 or multiplication of, plus or minus 1, addition of 0 and 1 mod 2. You know, you can have the same multiplication table, but different names for things and be thinking about the operations in very different ways. But, so those two groups are isomorphic. They're really the same group. Here, O3 and the Boolean group are two very different groups. I think this preserves... does this work right? So if I take phi of G... what is my operation here? This should be minus 1.
Yeah.
I had the wrong Boolean group. This is just multiplication. So if I take phi of G times phi of G prime, that has to be equal to phi of GG prime. Well, this is equal to plus or minus 1, and this is equal to plus or minus 1, prime. The determinant of G times the determinant of G prime is equal to the determinant of GG prime. So I think we're okay. That's the statement right there.
Yes.
So I've just proved that it preserves group multiplication insofar as it bothers to multiply at all. let's see. On the other hand,
does that mean that O3 is a covering group for pi group?
Well, what we can do, we can form the quotient group. Is H actually a subgroup of O3? Almost has to be. It seems to me we can look at O3 quotient by H. What do we get? Alright, H is a Boolean group. What do we get?
Yeah,
that's true. We get another group with the same algebra. So what surely is the case here is that H is actually a normal subgroup of G. Where I haven't defined normal subgroup for you guys, so don't worry if you don't know what that is. So this will fit into, you know, our nth theorem. I'm not sure how many of these results we need to prove, you know, for our gauge theory goals. I think that really proving this one for a discrete subgroup, we can make a good argument for it, because if we have a Lie group, it's some n-dimensional manifold, and we're dividing that up into at most a countable number of pieces. Well, each of those countable number of pieces needs to look pretty much the same because they're related by the discrete subgroup. Just like plus or minus one here relate the two parts of O3, the plus one and minus one determinant parts of O3. A discrete subgroup can't change the dimension of the manifold. And it can't change the local structure of a manifold. One of those pieces is going to have the identity in it, and the local structure around the identity is going to look the same as it did before the quotient. So we get the same Lie algebra. All right, there's the argument. I don't think I want to go deeper into it because it requires making a bunch of definitions and, you know, doing a sequence of proofs and developing more group theory technology than we really want to do right now. I mean, it's fun stuff, and you know, it all follows, and oh, you know, it's cool and all that, but it takes us too far afield. But you can see that something like this just really has to be the case.
I think that's a pretty good argument. You find the identity, take a small neighborhood, or go in every neighborhood, the identity there is.
Yeah, a discrete subgroup, you know, it's going to leave pieces. It's going to leave whole n-dimensional pieces. And, you know, one of those has got to look like, look the same.
I mean, you'd have to find it in every neighborhood.
Every
neighborhood at that point. A point in every neighborhood at that point, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I think the only thing you really need is that a discrete subgroup. One of the pieces that, you know, mapped by the discrete subgroup will contain the identity. You need it to contain an open set containing the identity. So once you prove that, I mean, that would be one approach to proving this. You could get it from that. Because now you've got an indecimal neighborhood, you can do all the Lie algebra stuff. Normal subgroup. Let's define a normal subgroup.
other claims did I make over here? Well, we can exponentiate the... Actually, that might be an interesting exercise for you guys. No, problem. Let's call it a problem. The second claim there. Suppose you have a Lie algebra. What's a Lie algebra? It's a vector space with a commutator, a closed commutator product with constant real coefficients. And the Jacobi identity. Anti-symmetric, yeah. So it's just something with those properties. Exponentiate
something with those
properties. Each of the elements of that vector space and prove that the thing you get satisfies the postulate of a group. A Lie group, in fact, but it'll be a Lie group because you've hit parameterized by reals. But, you know, prove the group properties. So, a vector space has an origin. The exponential of the origin is 1. There's your identity. The inverse, e to the... let's see what we can do right off the bat. E to the 0 is the identity. E to W dot generator. So we've got a bunch of generators. The inverse of that, what do you bet, is the minus W dot W. So we've got our inverse, let's see, closure.
I think that's going to be the hardest one.
Well, closure and associativity. You know, closure comes from that commutator product. All right. Use the Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff theorem. Anybody know it?
That's the commutator equals...
E to the whatever. E to the A times E to the B is E to the A plus B plus A B commutator plus A commutator A B plus an infinite string of other commutators. Okay, big, nasty, ugly formula. You don't even need to know the formula to prove closure of the group. Because the commutator is closed.
Right.
Every one of those commutators is a commutator in the Lie algebra. It gives you a Lie algebra element back.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right.
So, this is an element of G. We're done. Okay, so now use the Jacobi to prove associativity.
In between your problem statement and your we're done statement.
let me put some more stuff here. So
the problem statement and the we're done statement.
Let's A and B lie in the Lie algebra.
Then A and copies A, B all together
elements. A, B is an element of the Lie algebra.
Right. Okay.
Then A with A, B is an element of the Lie algebra, etc.
Okay.
All these commutators. So E to the A, E to the B equals E to the... some element of the Lie algebra, so that's an element of, of the exponential. So it is of the same form. It's the exponential of the Lie algebra element.
That's Campbell-Baker.
Did you get this?
Yes. Somehow makes me think of camping, but I don't know why.
Makes me think of soup, but,
the house or soup.
Of course. Chocolate. Yeah, I just think it's a made of soup and chocolate.
Okay. I don't know.
Okay.
You
know,
we do have soup a lot while camping, so maybe that's it.
Yeah. We're okay.
So we've got 3 out of 4. So trying to show that the Jacobi identity implies associativity in this product.
Okay, so let's turn it backwards.
Well, okay, you know, yeah, we showed that the associativity of the group implies associativity of the products of generators. Now, but does the Jacobi identity imply associativity of the generators? I'm not sure that's true. It might not. Because they're, you know, the Jacobi identity is actually a weaker statement than associativity. I'm pretty sure that's true. It's sort of a triple thing, right? So, yeah. But somewhere it sorts out. So anyway, I invite you to try that.
Why don't you show us?
Well, because I suspect it's long and messy, and you have to go in like any minute, 10 minutes.
I have to try on the head.
Yeah, I don't. All right. Yeah, we should make a
long and messy. There's not a chance for me. So. I'd like to. If you have to bring it together tomorrow, then we're not. Okay. Want to do that? Well, I don't have a lot of confidence that I'll need to do that.
Yeah, I don't have an approach in mind. You know, I'd probably have to sit down and fuss with it. You don't want to see me just stand
there. Okay. Well, I'll leave these 4 lines blank.
So I just fit it in there, okay. I'll come up with something very elegant.
I'll give you a call tomorrow. Dinner's good. I'm going to be at the library from Principal Min and the study group, and then after that.
And then I've got a study group of 1, so we have a whole lot of people that just emerald and stuff. Go down to the cafe.
I'll just text you about that time.
Okay.
Alright.
Off I go. Is that how we said subgroup?
Yeah.
Was that our symbol?
That was our.
I'll go ahead and define this.
I think it was capital G.
Was it capital G?
No.
It's
just messing with you.
Your student just called you a nerd. That's what I heard.
Haven't
you? He said, "We're such nerds."
You failed. Get another element of H. We can write, we can actually write GH, G inverse is contained in, either properly or improperly contained in H. It's either all of H or some of H or something. We can write it that way too. So that's a normal subgroup. And the claim. Let's make a claim. The claim is that the quotient of a group by a normal subgroup is another group. Improper subset, it's the whole thing. So what I'm saying is, if I sandwich every element of H in here, either I get a subset of H or I get all of H.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. For most of the examples we'll look at, you get all of H. But not necessarily. Then the quotient is a group. So, this is one fun. Let's try it. G mod H is the set of left cosets of H. And we need a product on coset. All right, now what does it mean to have a product on coset? So here's the idea. I have two cosets. I take an element from this one, I take an element from that one, and I multiply them using the product of G. You see the problem? What if I choose a different element and a different element and take their product? What guarantees that I end up with the same third coset? So getting closure here is the real issue. We're going to be using the group product, so we're going to have inverses, and so that stuff will come in easily, just from the fact that the product we're defining is the product in a group already. But we closure is tricky. We need to be able to take G1 times G2H and get G3H. All right, that's what closure means. What should we name these? Don't want to call them H. Don't want to call them G. Well, letters. Let's let G prime be an element of G1H. G double prime an element of G2H. Define G1H times G2H to be equal to, let's see, I'm defining this product, to be equal to the coset of G prime, G double prime. Okay, so take the product of these two elements and form the coset. All right, so the definition takes two cosets and gives me a third coset. The problem is it independent of which elements I chose here? So we need to show prime, the double prime H is independent of which element the prime element of G1H, the double prime element G2H, we choose. So, if we can show that that's the case, then we've got a good definition here. Now, it's possible that it's sufficient to pick two elements of the first set, show that any two elements of the first set are going to give us the same thing. We could probably apply the same argument to the second set. We'll see if anything we do depends on which one we choose. So, let's see. G1 prime, G2 prime, the element of G1H. Is that notation okay?
Then I'm going to have to skate.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see if we get this.
Okay.
Do you need to go on? Oh, okay. Well, we'll finish this next time. That's very good. Right, so, something to think about over the weekend. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Use a lot of it?
No, not really. Good though. No. Why doesn't Arab friends want to do this? Just do an engineering student, pretend that you're an engineer. You can do that.
What's that?
Sorry. Why doesn't Arab friends want to interview a mechanical student? So,
well, more than aerospace.
Oh. What's that?
I'm more than aerospace.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But then you're going to hear a mechanical student.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be okay. I'm just,
it's like a live interview, or?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's for a class. His name is Muhammad. I've seen something, you know, so.
Oh, is that right? Like, okay.
Yeah.
Is it like live or like audio? Or?
I have no idea. I can give you an email. Yeah. Right. Right into yours.
Well, I can do it. It's like, what type of format it is, though.
Okay.
I mean, if it's like written or like, she wants to know like certain things about it, but. The problem, though, is I came from a different school.
Right.
So if she's asking, like, undergraduate mechanical engineering, I won't be able to answer that. If she were to ask, like, how is the mechanical engineering class this year?
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. Right. You'll answer things.
Right, exactly. I answer the main topics, like, what is mechanical engineering do, and whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, but sure, yeah, it's fine. As long as it's not like audio or. Well, I mean, as long as it's not like live. That was fine.
Can I get changed by this?
Sure.
Okay. like a mud view. Is that what you're saying? Something
there? Yeah, I'm
good. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Are you doing that for class, or?
I think we're doing it for a class, yeah.
Oh.
Okay. I just did an email interview, but after we learned.
What's that?
I just did an email interview about you, actually, last week.
First you write an article for the... Rebecca Dixon,
I think. Yeah, I think so, right, yeah. Yeah, so what would be the best personal telephone or email? Like, it doesn't matter, but I can answer on my own time. Well, it's his email, so.
Yeah.
She has some questions about how you teach and research and stuff. And kind of
I should have warned you she was going to get more. I passed out names. Colon. Thanks for taking time to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Writing an article.
Well, I'm not sure if all these are correct, but here's the pointer.
All right.
After like a few months.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Now everybody else is in a real trouble.